In his autobiography, The Education of Henry Adams, Adams tells us that he was born into one world in the 19th century and lived on into another. Born in Quincy, Massachusetts in 1838, he lived to see a new world in the 20th century, a world in which a secular dynamo has replaced Venus and the Virgin, two manifestations of the transcendent that once animated the Western world. Venus, a cultural force in the pagan world, the Virgin in Christendom. Historian Adams saw unity, harmony, and beauty in that older world, but multiplicity, fragmentation, chaos, skepticism, and confusion in the new. Likewise, the old world was an orderly and beautiful creation for the scientist as well as the poet. The new, however, was merely colliding atoms, matter in motion, a chaos of anarchic and purposeless forces. Adams' account of the past and the present is reflected in Richard Weaver's work. Both admire the old ordered world with its distinction and hierarchy, its grand cathedrals, and the scholastic philosophy of St. Thomas. Adams was alarmed by the scientific and technological god of the new world, the dynamo. Weaver, by its offspring, the gods of mass and speed. For our purposes, what is most remarkable is that both writers emphasize a great divide or demarcation between two worlds. The older, more ordered world of 19th century America and the more fragmented and uncertain America of the 20th century. While Weaver sees the beginning of the end of that old world and the rise of nominalism in the 14th century, he still sees a relatively ordered and humane world still existing in mid-19th century America. Let us look at Weaver's essay, The Spaciousness of the Old Rhetoric, to see what light it sheds on these two worlds, especially what the old world had and the new world lost. In this essay from Weaver's The Ethics of Rhetoric, he analyzes rhetoric of America's 19th century orators. We have forgotten most of these orators as well as the occasions on which they spoke. Andrew Ewing in 1850 on the sale of public lands. Charles Faulkner in 1858 on the virtues of agrarianism. John C. Breckinridge in 1859 on the occasion of the Senate's move from the old to the new chamber. Rufus Cohate in 1845 addressing the law school in Cambridge on the American Bar Association's essentially conservative function. Weaver also mentions Lincoln's first and second inaugurals and the Gettysburg Address, the only orator and oratorical occasion most of us will remember. Examining these orations, Weaver finds what he calls spaciousness. This term designates a high-flown quality, a grand style, full of both historical and literary resonances, a freedom of purview that allows the orator to speak with conviction on principles and beliefs held in common with his audience, an aesthetic distance and decorum that envisioned the whole and did not trespass into crude familiarity, minute details, impertinent particulars, and obscene spectacles. Also, a belief in non-factual kinds of truth and a polite style that sounds good and respects the powers and limitations of the audience. Weaver contrasts each quality of the old oratory with the general practice and expectations of 20th century orators and audiences. His observations regarding oratory in the mid-20th century are easily related to oratory today. Audiences do not have enough time, patience, belief, or knowledge to appreciate the older orations. They prefer the petty and contemptuous style. They want evidence, not uncontested terms and propositions. They relish the personal, the particular, the spontaneous, the novel, the bottom line, not general truths, historical vistas, classical literary allusions, and pious and ceremonial rhetoric. And as for the polite old orator who respected his audience, they prefer the brash and crude speaker with his slogans and catchwords and his hurried and syncopated style. While Weaver does not illustrate the new oratory, he does mention two developments that have influenced it: modern journalism, with its penchant for impertinence and spectacle, he mentions Time magazine as an example, and our love affair with technological gadgets that give us instant photographic realism at the touch of a button. Here one thinks of Weaver's searing analysis of modern journalism and electronic media in The Great Stereopticon, chapter 5 of Ideas Have Consequences. Today's journalism, talk shows, and talk radio only confirm what Weaver said of the media in the 1950s. Our media and the consumer-related industries that promote them have conditioned us to the soundbite, the photo op, the bumper sticker slogan, and the ranting rhetorical food fights on talk shows. According to Weaver, the advantage the old rhetoric has over the new is the quality of spaciousness. One major aspect of this spaciousness is a happy homogeneity of belief, common presumptions of speaker and audience. Sharing beliefs and assumptions with his audience, the orator did not have to prove or define every term or premise in his oration. Ironically, what Weaver sees as an advantage many today would regard as a crippling and false limitation. But to give Weaver's point a contemporary application, think of the difficulties we encounter today when we assume there are two genders, and only two, or that marriage and the family and the person have some definite and normative meaning. If the speaker has to battle for his position at every turn, he will get nowhere. Actually, there is a homogeneity of belief in liberal quarters regarding a series of politically correct terms: change, choice, tolerance, inclusiveness, multiculturalism, to name only five. If Weaver were with us today, he would likely add these new terms to his list of ultimate terms in contemporary rhetoric. But of what did this homogeneity of belief in the 19th century consist? Weaver mentions the Constitution, Christianity, and a belief that history teaches some definite lessons about political goods and possibilities. I quote Weaver on this point. "Freedom and morality were constants. The Constitution was the codification of all that was politically feasible, Christianity of all that was morally authorized. Rome stood as an exemplum of what may happen to nations. The American and French revolutions had taught rulers their necessary limitations." There is a paradox here. Weaver mentions common convictions that radically limit moral and political choices. Paradoxically, Christian morality, the Constitution, history as political exemplum, the very forms that limit us protect us from our lower nature, free us to pursue good in personal and corporate ways. Weaver elaborates on the spaciousness of the old rhetoric, pointing out that it is spacious in two ways: temporal and cosmological. The temporal spaciousness is possible because orator and audience know and are comfortable with historical and literary resonances that reach back in time, all the way back to ancient Rome, even back to the book of Genesis. Weaver writes, "This continuity of the past with the present gave a dimension which our world seems largely to have lost." The old rhetoric was spacious in cosmological as well as temporal ways. The old orators believed that their world was connected to heaven or the transcendent. Discussing the personification and descent of liberty from heaven in one of the old orations, Weaver refers to the poeticized figment that connected two worlds. Let me quote him here. "This is how the gods of classical mythology came down to hold discourse with mortals. It is how the God of the Christian religion came into the world for the redemption of man. It is how the Logos is made incarnate. In other words, this kind of manifestation from above is, in our Western tradition, an archetypal process which the orators of that tradition are likely to follow implicitly." End quote. Today, one still finds orators and audiences comfortable with this archetypal connecting of two worlds. They tend to be Christian orators and audiences, and they also tend to be ignored, marginalized, or scorned by hostile liberal elites. What Weaver demonstrates with argument and illustration in his temperate essay and in the more critical and passionate Ideas Have Consequences and Visions of Order, our poets reveal with disturbing, terrifying images and symbols. Here is a brief series of quotations from poets from poems written between 1915 and 1942, with a few of my own comments appended. Wallace Stevens in Sunday Morning. We live in an old chaos of the sun, or island solitude, unsponsored, free. That is, there are no Platonic forms to seek or imitate, no first cause, no prime mover, no teleology, no creator, no providential guide. Yeats in The Second Coming. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. Christendom is disintegrating, and while it crumbles before our eyes, Yeats predicts an ominous and terrifying future. And what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches towards Bethlehem to be born. T.S. Eliot in The Wasteland, falling towers, Jerusalem, Athens, Alexandria, Vienna, London, unreal. Our spiritual, moral, cultural, and legal inheritance from these great cities is unreal or severely fragmented. So in our wasted land, if we are lucky, we can gather together a few of the fragments to shore up the ruins. Pound in Hugh Selwyn Moberly on what is left of Western civilization following the Great War. There died a myriad, and of the best among them, for an old bitch gone in the teeth, for a botched civilization, for two gross of broken statues, for a few thousand battered books. Western civilization lives, but mostly in museums and libraries, not in the hearts, minds, homes, and cities of America and Europe. Wallace Stevens, once again, he tells us in Modern Poetry that the old poets had their scene and script, but that the modern poet is a metaphysician in the dark, creating out of his mind and his mind alone whatever order he perceives. These poets are telling us the same thing Weaver and Adams claim. We live in a different world than our ancestors did, for we have lost contact with both tradition and the transcendent, two things that made that older world larger, more spacious than our own. The Constitution, Christianity, and a long historical memory that served to exemplify the possible, the desirable, and the dangerous, these three things oriented 19th century discourse. While these things still influence discourse today, they do not do so in the same way. The Constitution, for Weaver's 19th century orator, was received from our forefathers. It was vigorous and inviolate. I don't think modern legislators and Supreme Court justices view that document the same way the founders and 19th century orators did. In Planned Parenthood of Southwestern Pennsylvania versus Casey, a majority of the United States Supreme Court justices maintained that at the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. This sounds like all sail and no anchor to me. In the founding generation and in the 19th century, the God-given inalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness mentioned in the Declaration were circumscribed, anchored by historical memory, by prescriptive rights and duties, by revelation and common law. The latitude of the Supreme Court's definition of liberty is frightening. Now, it is true that the Constitution has been amended, that earlier notions of liberty and equality have been expanded to include blacks and women. These changes are compatible with Christianity and natural law. But if I may use a Weaver term in a different way, allowing every man to define reality any way he pleases is a bit too spacious. To my mind, it suggests the Dostoevskian theme, if God does not exist, everything is permitted. Something more than human whim, or the self-centered pursuit of happiness must guide us in establishing social and cultural norms and setting limits to law and public policy. At the conclusion of the spaciousness of the old rhetoric, Weaver hints at what this something is in summarizing his essay and emphasizing its key point. He writes that the old orator's speech was informed by his epistemology. He believed that true knowledge somehow had its source in the mind of minds, for which we are on occasion permitted to speak a part. The age or the man who has a true conception of knowledge, Weaver says, will have the key to every other question. And I'm run out of time here, so I'm going to fast forward, move right into the conclusion, and which follows here. This older rhetoric spaciousness that allowed us to move back in time through history and tradition, and that joined us with the transcendent world, this is a spaciousness that is still available to us. We have moved away from it into a limited and barren world. Henry Adams, but especially Richard Weaver, point us back to that older spaciousness, and we should let that spaciousness be a part of our mind, our heart, and our speech today.